coverage of USA Today. It's my pleasure to host Diane Rehm's podcast, On My Mind. Welcome. On My Mind this week.
We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
Washington, indeed much of the country, is still trying to absorb the news of an attack on Republican congressmen as they practice at a park for a charity baseball game. I talk with veteran political analyst Norm Ornstein to get his perspective.
If we give any kind of a additional platform or legitimacy to hateful language, and it can come from all across the board, we are abetting this coarsening of the culture that leads us down a very bad path.
Earlier in the week, I spoke with Democratic strategist Jeff Garin on what we should and should not read into state election results as we head toward the 2018 midterms.
I do think that the 2018 elections are much more likely to be a referendum on whether voters want to have in our political system and system of government checks and balances on Donald Trump.
First, Norm Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norm, our thoughts are with Congressman Steve Scalise and the four others who were injured by the gunman who opened fire while members of the congressional GOP were practicing for a charity baseball game. Since then, we've heard some express the hopeful note that this terrible event will lead to a pullback in our overheated politics. But before we talk about that, you've been in Washington a long time. What's the hometown reaction you've seen to this shooting?
Fear and apprehension, and I think just people are generally stunned. But I wouldn't say stunned in the sense of deeply surprised. We've seen an enormous amount of violence, including gun violence, surrounding the entire political process. And that includes, somebody from the alt-right going about 25 minutes from Washington and shooting a soldier, an African-American soldier. It includes, of course, a lot of other acts of violence. And that are motivated to some degree by political differences, but also, of course, involve, in many cases, people who are simply unhinged. But if you put those two things together and then throw in what all of us in Washington have seen emerge full-blown over the last couple of decades, long before Trump, but encouraged in the era of Trumpism, which is this partisan tribalism, the sense that people on the other side are not your adversaries, but enemies who are trying to undermine America's way of life, it creates a chill here. You wonder who will be next and whether there will be a tit for tat. And unfortunately, Susan, one of the things that I find particularly troubling is the number of people in the political arena who are not using this as an occasion to try and damp down some of that destructive tribalism, but are exploiting it. And I find that not just among the political figures who are going on television or giving comments to reporters and blaming the other side for all of this. But I did a tweet last night that said, I'm praying for Steve Scalise and hoping for a full recovery. We all should. And I got a number of responses that said, this guy's trying to destroy America. There's a reaction out there from people who otherwise you would not imagine are dark forces. That reflects a coarsening of the culture that is a really troubling thing. And I see that reflected in conversations of concern around the city.
It is true. Of course, there's been that reaction on Twitter and other social media platforms. A few members of Congress have said this is anti-Trump rhetoric contributed to this shooting. But we saw the president, that both the Republican and Democratic leaders of the House and others generally, I think, try to say this is shocking and a moment that ought to prompt us to kind of reassess this course we've been on for years.
And I thought the speaker, Paul Ryan's comments were particularly eloquent. I commend the president for not going off on a Twitter rant. about this, but being restrained as well. That's at least a little bit of a hopeful sign. But when you see major figures in our politics and our discourse, Newt Gingrich, to pick one example, the former speaker going on Fox News and saying this is all caused by the left, you worry a little bit that there'll be a counter reaction. It'll be, well, they took out one of ours, we'll take out one of theirs. And there's still enough people with platforms who, whether they are cynically trying to exploit this or just reacting viscerally, we need more actions like those of the Speaker, of Minority Leader Pelosi, of the President and others to try and keep this from becoming a larger problem. And you worry, too, whenever you have either mass shootings or mass killings, they become major features in our news that it encourages others, copycats or those who do react viscerally. Let's face it, in a society where there's easy access to a lot of weapons of mass destruction.
You know, it's a conundrum, I think, for journalists in some ways, because the more coverage you give to it, the more that might encourage someone who is a publicity seeker, wants to go out in a flame of attention, if not glory. But on the other hand, you can hardly keep yourself from covering an event like the one that we saw this week.
It has to be covered. You hope that there isn't a lot of focus on the person who did it, you know, making that person into a kind of media star. But, you know, there are a couple of other features of this that are themselves unsettling. One is that while this guy had some history of at least of some domestic violence, and there certainly seems to be a lot of that that ends up resulting in something more tragic. In other ways, you wouldn't have made him a person of interest or picked him out in advance as somebody who might go off on this kind of destructive rampage. And that means that, you know, these things can happen without any either advance notice or without any great ability to find protection. And that, along with the easy access to weapons, means that you have to move at least to some degree away from the kind of freedom that we've seen. You know, I remember back during the Clinton administration, there was a period of time where there was great concern, and we also saw this in the period immediately after 9/11, where cabinet officers were given security details and had to go everywhere with those security details. And are we going to have security details for all of the members of Congress? We had some concern about that after the tragic shooting of Gabby Giffords and, of course, the deaths of many others in Arizona a number of years ago. The access that people have to their members of Congress, which is a part of our freedom, if we begin to take that away, we really lose something even more significant. And, you know, at the same time, frankly, if members use this as an excuse not to hold town meetings, not to have dialogues with their constituents, there's already been a move away from that long before an incident of this sort. We lose once again some of the hallmarks of representation and the political freedom we've had in America.
You know, one of the things that I think probably surprised a lot of Americans was when they learned that even though there were two dozen or so members of Congress at this baseball field in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, the only reason that there were Capitol security officers there was because one of the players was Steve Scalise, number three in the House leadership. As a member of the leadership, he had a protective detail. But if that protective detail had not been there, Senator Flake and others said that they thought they might all be killed by this gunman before Alexandria police had time to get there.
And let's just think about the implications of that, that it would have taken many minutes for police to arrive. And in that time, we could have had 30 members of Congress, all Republicans, killed. That would have meant no majority in the House, none in the Senate necessarily, that have been elected by the people. And in the House, the only way you can fill vacancies is by special elections that take months. we can't afford to have a representative system that doesn't operate for months at a time. It would bring a halt to the legislative process, or at least create the possibility for actions that otherwise we might see as illegitimate. This is a concern that I have had since 9/11, and I began to write about this in the immediate aftermath. United 93 was headed for the Capitol Dome. If it had not left 45 minutes late from Newark, it probably would have arrived and hit the Capitol at around the same time as the other planes hit the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. We could have been without a working majority in Congress. The Constitution says you need a quorum of half the members for many, many months at the worst possible time. So I helped to create a continuity of government commission, and we had recommendations that if you end up with some kind of a crisis, you can immediately fill those positions temporarily with interim appointments until you can hold real elections and enable the government to move forward in its full components immediately. That was almost 16 years ago, and Congress has basically done nothing of significance to deal with this problem. I hope this becomes a wake-up call to realize that it is not that difficult to behead the constitutional system for a significant period of time. And that doesn't mean security details are enough. It means that we need to have a process which may require a constitutional amendment for emergency interim appointments in the face of some kind of disaster. And we know now that that kind of disaster doesn't require hijacking a plane. It can happen with one deranged individual.
You know, we talked about this vitriolic rhetoric that's become very much part of this kind of standard political debate. And a couple years ago, I think people were shocked by some of the things that were posted online with stories on Twitter, on Facebook. But I wonder, in a way, if we've all just become kind of used to that kind of rhetoric in our society.
You know, I do think that for all the wonders that the technological revolution has brought us, I'm sitting at my computer with instant access to more information than the entire federal government would have been able to amass in the Defense Department and NASA and every other place 40 years ago. With that has come another reality. There are so many voices out there. There's such a cacophony. There's so much easy access to anything, one click away from vile pornography, horrible violence. Cutting through the noise requires now a kind of shock value, and we have coarsened our culture over a period of time so that almost anything goes. You can say the most vile things, racist things, misogynistic things, horrible things on television, and then you're back the next day. And you can write the most awful things. And now, under the guise of anonymity on social media, people who would have felt a sense of shame before are unleashed. And the more we see that, the more it encourages others or it brings a kind of counter-reaction. We need a larger wake-up call than the partisan tribalism. We need to think about ways in which we can put some constraints on this process and bring back at least a sense of shame when people cross a line. And I must tell you, one of the things that I found most disturbing was when President Trump feted Ted Nugent, among others, at the White House, a man who has who called President Obama a half-breed mongrel, who has encouraged violence, who said awful things. We shouldn't be highlighting or encouraging these things. And I am not really thrilled to see Megyn Kelly and NBC showcase and give greater legitimacy to Alex Jones, who, among other things, of course, said that Sandy Hook was a hoax. if we give any kind of a additional platform or legitimacy to hateful language, and it can come from all across the board, we are abetting this coarsening of the culture that leads us down a very bad path, a bad path for any kind of national unity or a sense of a larger identity with America and not dividing into divisive groups. But also that can be and can encourage others to do very bad things.
We've seen in the aftermath of the shooting here some demonstrations of bipartisanship. After the night of the shooting, the Democratic congressional baseball team invited the Republican team to dinner at the Democratic Club, and this was hailed. And what struck me was that that was a nice gesture, but what was most remarkable was that it was seen as remarkable that members of Congress of different parties might just have dinner together. Are we at the point where that is a phenomenal thing?
Sadly, yes. And, you know, it used to be, yeah, I've been here longer than you have, but we've both been here long enough to remember times when people on the other side were often allies and were seen more as worthy adversaries, and where you had friendships and family friendships. And there's still some of that. You still see some of it in the Senate, but it has gone way downhill. And there are many reasons for it. One of them goes back to 1994, when the Republicans took the majority in the House, and Newt Gingrich encouraged the new members coming in not to bring their families to Washington because it was a cesspool, and leave them back home. And when families lived here, there was interaction, and it was interaction across the board. That was a part of it. The fundraising dynamic, where now every spare minute you're running off the Capitol grounds to raise money for yourself and for the team instead of schmoozing with your colleagues. That's another part of it. And, of course, the tribal element. But all of that has created a different atmosphere, and there's less comedy in the House and Senate. And I can't say that I'm terribly optimistic. You know, it's wonderful that we're going to see the baseball game go forward, and we will see members embrace, and we will see some sense of unity. We see that with the prayer breakfasts that occur every Wednesday in the Capitol, where you get at least some bonding. But then we move back to what's become the reality of our political life. We have a health care measure moving forward in the Senate that has completely shut out Democrats and a lot of Republicans and most outsiders, and is going to have a bill sprung with no hearings and 10 hours of debate. No matter how much they embrace each other as human beings, that's not going to change. I don't see the fundamentals of how we move forward on critical issues like budget priorities or even the debt ceiling that will not break down the way we have seen it before along stark partisan lines. So it may be a first step, a necessary condition to create more human-to-human contact and a sense that other people are genuine human beings who just have different views on things. But until there is a larger sense that it is in your own interest to work with them and to compromise, this will be a few nice gestures that will disappear before long.
And I think that even some optimists are worried this will be like 6 years ago when Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona, was shot. There was a speech by the then House Speaker, John Boehner, that was very much like the speech we heard Paul Ryan give this time. And yet the moves toward unity and comedy in the wake of that shooting did not last very long.
No. And, you know, one of the things that even struck me back then was when Gabby came back, one of the first people to embrace her and one who had been most stricken by the horrible thing that happened was Louie Gohmert of Texas. They had, you know, built some kind of friendship. And that was extraordinary and touching. But then if you look at Louie Gohmert in the years since, few people have said more inflammatory things than he. So I don't hold out a lot of hope that these speeches are going to be pivotal moments.
You know, another thing happened just hours after this shooting, which was a report in the Washington Post and confirmed by other news outlets, that the special counsel Robert Mueller has expanded his Russia probe to include possible obstruction of justice by President Trump. And I just wonder if there's any prospect of lowering the temperature of our rhetoric if we're going to be in the midst of an investigation that threatens the president.
You would sure hope so. But we saw the president, of course, have another flurry of angry tweets, this time calling it a witch hunt. We had the Newt Gingrich yet again saying that Mueller was a tool of the deep state, this sort of conspiracy to undermine the president. You would hope that we would have a different arc here. Now, I do want to say, if you look back at the Nixon era and the process that moved towards impeachment of the president, it took some time, including the select committee hearings in the Senate that are so famous, and we remember now with Sam Ervin and especially Howard Baker, one of the great giant statesmen of the 20th century, saying what did the president know and when did he know it, going through that to create a different atmosphere and a broader consensus, including Republican leaders, whose initial and visceral reaction was to protect their president. And then we got, I think, the bipartisanship that resolved this without the deep crisis that could have been there. So it'll take a while, I think, for that same tribal instinct to move in a different direction. But if what you get is a kind of rhetoric that says that this is a conspiracy, and now we have a different age. We have an age of tribal media and the amplification of social media, you get these kinds of divisions where a sizable core of voters, and this is going to be people who make up a majority of many congressional districts and primaries in states for senators, who believe that this is all a phony conspiracy to undermine Trump, then it's going to be much harder to move in a careful direction towards just simply finding out what the facts are and moving to a conclusion from that point forward. I would say, despite all the efforts to undermine Bob Mueller, it would be hard to find a person better suited to this task with a broader reputation for probity and honesty and integrity. And that's a comforting thing.
And of course, we've also heard Republican congressional leaders endorsing Robert Mueller as a man of honor. So that may be encouraging as well. Just one last question, Norm. I was wondering if this time, this very tumultuous time, remind you of any previous time in American history? I know you've paid a lot of attention to American history. I've heard some people compare it to 1968 when we had civil rights demonstrations, anti-war rallies. We had a president under who was embattled, although the Watergate scandal, of course, was to come only in the future. Does this remind you of anything that we've done, that we've gone through before?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, Susan. I'm just finishing a book with E.J. Dionne and Tom Mann on it's on the age of Trumpism, not just Trump, and what are the historical analogies. And we have them. We have had many periods in American history of deep divisions going back to the beginning, and obviously including the enormous tension in the 1820s that brought the populist revolution of Andrew Jackson, the period leading up to the Civil War, the tumult of the 1930s surrounding the Depression and populism on the right and the left, Father Coughlin on the right, Huey Long on the left, that period in the 1960s with Vietnam, with civil rights demonstrations, with riots in the streets, with Bull Connor and fire hoses and the bombing of the Birmingham church and all kinds of other actions that brought tension, and then the almost unprecedented, certainly in our lifetimes and at that time in more than 100 years, the impeachment of Richard Nixon. So we've had these crises before. But I would say that this is a different time, and the closest analogy we may have in the tribalism that exists out there and the dangers to civil society and to the fundamentals of governing, it may be the lead up to the Civil War. Now, we're not going to have, I think, a civil war, but we really do have to take a deep breath right now. We've got the reality that voters are more motivated by negative partisanship than an attachment to their own party. It's much more, we've got to stop these evil people from destroying America, than it is, I believe in my own party. And then you put that together with the other reality of our politics, that our parties are dividing more and more along racial regional lines. We have a Republican Party that's becoming overwhelmingly a white party. It's moving in the wrong direction from the, remember, Reince Priebus's autopsy, that we have to broaden that base. And a Democratic Party that's becoming really more of a coalition of minorities as the country moves towards having a majority consisting of those minorities. You layer race and some of the religious divisions and ethnic divisions on top of partisan tribalism, and it is really combustible. We didn't have that to nearly the same extent, I think, in the 1960s, and we had a different party system where Democrats and Republicans could find some common ground in the middle, and where you had statesmen like Howard Baker and Hugh Scott joining with Democrats to try and preserve the Union and find some common ground. It's much harder now, and I find it deeply troubling. We are seeing at least some counter-reaction, a civil society that's trying to stand up and find a different way forward. I'm hopeful on that front, but I'm fearful otherwise.
Norm Ornstein, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back.
Hello.
Hey, Jeff, it's Susan Page.
Susan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
And now, Jeff Guerin. He's a Democratic pollster with Peter Hart Research Associates. Thanks for doing the Diane Rehm podcast.
I am delighted to do the Diane Rehm, Susan Page podcast.
Jeff, we have next week a special House election in Georgia. It's gotten a lot of attention and a ton of money, more than $40 million. So far, most expensive House race in U.S. history. This is for that seat that Republican Tom Price, now the Secretary of Health and Human Services, held. Do you think the Democrat, John Ossoff, is going to beat Karen Handel, the Republican, for that seat?
My instinct certainly would be yes. There was a poll the other day, a public poll, that had Ossoff ahead. But to me, the more important point was, of the people who voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, overwhelmingly, they said that they wanted to cast a vote that would reflect their opposition to Donald Trump. And for the people who voted for Donald Trump, very few of them, I think it was like just around a third, said that they wanted to cast a vote that was reflective of their support for Donald Trump. And I think with that kind of difference in energy around the president, it could make a very big difference in a very close race.
You know, some Democrats are pretty optimistic that in the midterms next year, Democrats will regain control of the House. I think that means picking up 24 seats. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it can. I think that, Donald Trump's Gallup approval rating, he was at 60% disapprove, only 36% approve. At those kinds of numbers, you have dramatic changes in midterm elections. The most predictive thing in a midterm election is the incumbent president's approval rating. And, you know, we've had Bill Clinton at a similar point, had a low approval rating, and there were dramatic turnover in the House in 1994, of course. But at least in Bill Clinton's case, when he had a low approval rating at this point in his term, he had already planted the seeds for his own and the country's recovery. He had spent political capital on passing a budget that reduced the deficit and created revenues to make important investments. Donald Trump has gotten to this very low point already without having really accomplishing anything or not doing anything that you know, will bear dividends further down the road. So I would not be surprised if Donald Trump's approval ratings go even lower than they are today. And if they're that low, I think it would it would lead one to expect pretty sweeping changes in the House.
You know, there's another parallel with the Bill Clinton years, and that is that there are some Democrats who have begun to talk about the possibility of impeaching President Trump. Some of the Democratic leaders have tried to tamp down that talk. Is that a smart thing for Democrats to be talking about?
No, and I don't know that it's particularly consequential. Look, there are a lot of people, mainly Democrats, but not only Democrats, who are, you know, deeply concerned about what Donald Trump means for the kind of the legal and democratic processes of our country, and so that they, you know, take this quite seriously. I think a lot of this will depend on what Robert Mueller finds, as opposed to kind of the political conversation, and so this is going to play itself out. In the meantime, I think it's really important, much more important for Democrats to be emphasizing to voters of how bad the health care policies and the tax policies and the budget policies are of President Trump and the Republicans, and the ways in which those policies make it even harder for people in the middle class who are trying to get into the middle class. And shift more and more of the economic burdens in our country onto their backs.
So politically speaking, is it enough to make the case that President Trump is dangerous, his policies are dangerous, and that there's no real onus on Democrats to come up with, to either pass their own policies? Of course, you say that'd be difficult. They don't have control of the House or the Senate or the White House. Is it enough to be against Trump?
I think both in the House and the Senate, Democrats will articulate a positive agenda. But at the end of the day, the reality is that Donald Trump and the Republicans are in charge. And the dominant question in the election is it okay to have Republicans who will rubber stamp Donald Trump's policies and Donald Trump's conduct of the presidency? Or do we need to have real checks and balances in the system? And that's not just going to be sort of a commentary on whether I like my individual congressman or congresswoman, but also, do I want to have more Democrats in Congress in order to have more of a check on Donald Trump? I do think that through lots of experience of 2006, 2010, and 2014, it is very likely that that question, more than any other question, will drive the midterm elections.
You know, we may have learned something about the political state of affairs with the election, the primary elections that we had in Virginia this week. And to the surprise of many, the Democratic contest turned out not to be close. And in fact, the candidate you were working for, Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, easily won the nomination over former Congressman Tom Perriello. Does that tell us anything? What does it tell us about the Democratic Party that that election that we thought might be close was not?
Well, the most important thing about that election was the number of people who turned out to participate in it. And to me, that's where the most significant national implications are. The previous competitive Democratic primary election for governor in Virginia was in 2009, and about 320,000 people voted in that primary election. And there was a lot of money spent. It was a very high-profile race. In this year's Virginia Democratic primary, we had about 540,000 people vote. So we went from 320,000 to 540,000, which is enormous, obviously. And I would guess that something in the neighborhood of half the people, or maybe 40%, somewhere between 40% and half the voters who participated, did not have previous state primary vote history.
So these were not people who had been active in politics before. You have to be a pretty dedicated
voter. I think they voted in the 2016 Democratic primary, the vote in general elections. But to me, this is a sign of just how engaged and motivated Democratic voters are today. We're seeing this not only in Virginia, but really across the country. You know, I think Democrats are hyper-concerned about the direction of things under Donald Trump, and just the level of attention they're paying is greater. And on the other side, you know, there's a lot of feeling of sort of pessimism bordering on depression among a lot of Republicans. And so we're seeing a kind of the kind of enthusiasm gap that worked against Democrats in 2010 and 2014, but for Democrats in 2006, playing out again. But, you know, that in the Virginia Democratic primary for governor, the national narrative about the race was wholly disconnected from the reality of what was happening.
The national narrative was that candidate was the establishment
candidate.
Soul
of the Democratic Party. And if that's what it was, nobody told the voters of Virginia that, because they didn't see it that way at all. And part of the reason for the large turnout is that there were two candidates who voters really liked. In our last poll, I think Ralph Northam's favorability rating was 70% positive to 4% negative, and Tom Perriello's was 66-6. So that, you know, these were two immensely popular and well-liked candidates, and voters saw both of them as progressive.
But you know, one reason that fed that narrative was that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, kind of the drivers of the progressive agenda for Democrats, both endorsed Tom Perriello. That was one reason he was seen as really having a shot at this race. Was there something that did they fail to deliver with that endorsement? Is there a message there?
As a researcher, I want to be cautious in the sense that this was a state election and not a federal election. But I think in a state election, people were more concerned about Virginia and getting things done in Virginia. I think the Northam campaign had a more state-focused orientation to it. And I do think that there is a lesson there, certainly in gubernatorial races. But both candidates took on Donald Trump equally and forcefully. Dr. Northam, sometimes in colorful language. But, you know, I think that, you know, the lesson may be that in a state-based race, that focusing on the, you know, state issues is a important thing for candidates to do.
Let's talk just for a moment about the Republican side, because if it was a surprise that Northam didn't have that much trouble winning, the Democratic nomination, it was a surprise that Ed Gillespie just barely won the Republican nomination over Corey Stewart, who had really aligned himself with President Trump. And I wonder what you make of that result. Did that surprise you as it did many others?
It did, you know, that, you know, by any historic calculation, Ed Gillespie ought to have won that nomination handily. He spent much more money. He had a lot of establishment party support. I think it sort of reflects two things. One is just how divided the Republican Party is between the Trump faction and the non-Trump faction. And the Trump faction is, in Virginia at least, represents a half, if not more, of who turned out to vote. And I was saying earlier about the kind of level of depression and disengagement of more moderate Republicans. I think that may have been happening as well. Republicans like Ed Gillespie are between a rock and a hard place. You know, with Donald Trump, you can't live with him and you can't live without him, in a way that is that, you know, what Donald Trump represents, I think, is anathema to many mainstream voters in the state. But it's obviously there's a political cost for Republican candidates to abandon and disown Trump.
So Republicans have some challenges, but I've got to say, I think Democrats have some challenges as well. They're united in opposing President Trump, that's clear. But just how far left the Democratic Party ought to go is something that on which there is a difference of opinion. You have all this energy behind the most progressive part of the party. But if the Democrats are going to have success in, say, regaining control of the House next year, you're going to need to win in districts where you have to appeal to very moderate voters. So do you see this as a challenge ahead for Democrats over the next year?
I would never trade our problems for their problems. Their problems are much, much deeper. And honestly, I don't think this is a big problem for Democrats. It's something that the party is going to have to work through in its nominating process in 2020, for sure. But I do think
the 2018 elections are much more likely to be a referendum on whether voters want to have in our political system and system of government checks and balances on Donald Trump. And it will be, you know, much more of a referendum on Donald Trump. We ran a very progressive campaign in Virginia. Ralph Northam did, Dr. Northam did. But there's nothing that we talked about in the primary election that I think will be an impediment to running a very successful campaign in the general election. We talked about expanding health care coverage for people. Ralph is a strong advocate for letting women make their own reproductive health care choices. He's a very strong advocate for common sense gun legislation. He is for making sure that education is well funded. I think these are all positions that represent the center of gravity in Virginia politics. And Susan, what are some things where you think where Democrats are going too far left that will be problems in a year from November?
Well, here's one possibility: health care. We know there's going to be a big debate about that. It seems like there is very much have reinforced their view that a single-payer health care system would have been the way to go. So that is an issue on which you might see a divide in the Democratic Party, it seems to me.
It may be a divide in the Democratic Party, but the reality is that the focal point in the 2018 congressional elections are going to be what the Republicans want to do in terms of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Honestly, nobody's under the illusion that Democrats are in a position right now to pass anything. And so that this is really going to be about whether people want to hold Republicans and hold President Trump accountable for health care policies that most people, when they learn about them, feel are diametrically opposed to their own personal interests.
Jeff, let me ask you just one last question. You were the pollster 4 years ago for Terry McAuliffe for his successful run for governor in Virginia. Do you think Terry McAuliffe wants to run for the Democratic presidential nomination next time around?
Honestly, I don't know, but I am biased, obviously. But objectively speaking, he has been a great governor for Virginia. One thing I particularly appreciate about Terry is, and you know this, is that he really is an optimistic person. And I think one of the things we need in the Democratic Party, whether it's Terry McAuliffe or somebody else, when we get to the 2020 election, we need a candidate who will give people a sense of hope that their lives can be better if they elect him or her as president. And I really appreciate and admire the feeling of optimism that Terry conveys. It's almost, if you stand next to him, you feel it, that the kind of optimism he projects is an important part of success in current American politics.
Hey, Jeff, thank you very much. Thanks
for
your time.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
Okay.
Take care.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. And now, from the archives this week, in January 2011, Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Gifford survived a shooting that claimed the lives of six others, including a federal judge and a 9-year-old child. The deadly attack sparked a national conversation about how a coarsening of our political discourse may have played a role. Here's Glenn Nye, former representative of the 2nd District of Virginia, on the Diane Rehm Show shortly after that attack.
You can be adamant about an issue, you can even be emotional about an issue, but you have to tone it down, you have to draw a line somewhere where you get into when you start preying on people's fears and, like Jim said, start to make the other person in the conversation look like they're a bad person. That leads us down the wrong path. And I think it's important to note here that this conversation is valid even though we don't yet know what the motivations of the Arizona shooter were. That's important to note. We're not trying to point fingers at anyone, but this is a moment where our country needs to have this conversation. It's a moment where there's an opportunity for political leadership, for folks to stand up and say, number one, hey, I may have been part of the problem. And if I was, I'm sorry. Let's move forward now. I'm going to lead us the way forward and say, let's change our tone. I'll start with myself, and I'm going to be willing to set an example that other people will follow.
You can listen to that entire show on dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Send us an email at drpodcast@wamu.org. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Page of USA Today.